Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Mr. Prime Minister, your nation has suffered a cruel and unfair tragedy this week. People are hurt, but we are all of us going to help.
That's Secretary of State John Kerry speaking today in Brussels about this week's terrorist attacks. Details coming up.
Also, Bulgaria may build a fence along its border with Greece to block migrants and refugees from entering. And the Nigerian army says it freed more than 800 people this week who were being held by Boko Haram militants.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Brussels. He's meeting with both Belgian and European Union officials following Tuesday's terrorist attacks. Kerry met with Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel and later spoke briefly before reporters.
Mr. Prime Minister, your nation has suffered a cruel and unfair tragedy this week. People are hurt, but we are all of us going to help. No act of terror can undermine the foundation of our friendship or the values that define our alliance. Our fundamental openness, tolerance, and diversity, our pursuit of justice, our dedication to preserving the blessings of freedom for ourselves, our children, and generations to come. On Tuesday, lives were viciously cut short, and hundreds were injured. It is with irreplaceable loss in mind that we will renew our vow to come together against a common enemy in order to keep our people safe. And it is with their memory in our hearts that we must always stand in solidarity as friends, as allies, and partners.
Kerry says the U.S. and Belgium had already scheduled a number of counterterrorism training sessions.
In Belgium's capital, Brussels, police raids continue in Schaarbeek and other districts that may be harboring Islamic terrorists. Media reports say witnesses heard loud blasts and shots from heavy weapons during one raid, which involved scores of officers. Last Tuesday, Islamic terrorists bombed the city's subway system and airport, killing over 30 people and injuring over 300. Reporter Esther Judah is in Brussels. VOA's William Meagle asked her for an update on the situation there.
So in regards to the raids, the latest that we have is they've been ongoing throughout the morning, this morning. Two destinations were heard, two explosions, and a small amount of gunshot. L'Histoire, which is the Belgian news agency, is reporting that the two destinations were related to the police as opposed to a battle. The mayor of Schaarbeek has said that as far as he's been concerned, the operation is now over since 3 o'clock our time here in Brussels. However, I can tell you that on the scene, the roads are still closed and the police are very much still present in the area and people have not been allowed both in and out of the closed-off area. In terms of the investigation, is that French police conducted a raid yesterday in which they arrested one person related to the Paris attacks and also the Belgian attacks, and one person has been arrested in Schaarbeek this morning, along with a number of other people yesterday.
What type of neighborhood is Schaarbeek?
Well, Schaarbeek is a relatively mixed neighborhood. It's one of the largest neighborhoods of Brussels. And I can also say it's relatively divided into between two sections, a higher end of Schaarbeek, which is a much more bourgeois area, very chic area almost, I could say, and then a lower part of Schaarbeek, which is much closer to the Gare du Nord. So as in any neighborhood close to one major train station, it's much poorer than the second half of it. But it's a big, big neighborhood. It's in certain parts of it, it's in walking distance from the European institutions, and also from Malbec metro station, which was the victim to the second bombing on Tuesday morning.
In the press and in public discussions, what topics are being debated with regard to potential failures of security? Is there very much finger-pointing? Is there very much analysis of what went wrong and also what might be done to improved the security situation?
Well, I can say there's a very much a sort of schizophrenic discussion happening, certainly within the political class, I would say, less than what's happening on the street or between people in the city of Brussels. At 2 o'clock, the parliament held an inquest in which the government were investigated, I would say, in a kind of political capacity, of which the interior minister, the prime minister, and the justice minister accepted that there had been failures on their part. Yesterday evening, the justice minister and the interior minister offered their resignation, of which the prime minister Michel rejected, saying in time of war we needed to stand together, and there was no time for resignation. This seems almost a sort of orchestrated act in which they would resign, take responsibility, but then stay within the government. Obviously, let's see what will happen in the long term in terms of this coalition, and a very fragile coalition, can I say, for a country with multiple different identities. In terms of what's happening now is that the raids are ongoing. And one of the suspects from Tuesday morning is still out on the loose, there is very much a sense that we're in need of direction and we're in need of a strong leadership. Be it or not, if it's capable of it, there needs to be some form of leadership.
The EU met as well.
Yesterday evening, the EU did meet. This is a scheduled European Council. When the European Council meets, that means the heads of states of the European member states come together and discuss the issue of high priority, which obviously security was the number one thing to discuss.
And was anything released from that meeting regarding any resolutions to work more closely together in terms of intelligence sharing?
So President of the European Commission, who's obviously present at the Council meeting, Mrs. Juncker, said that made a statement saying we needed a security union. However, this is a rather ambiguous title and request. I mean, the issue of security is that it comes under member state competences, which means it's not actually under the jurisdiction of the European Union to act on specifically. We do have some forms of European institutions, such as the Europol, which is supposed to be the sharing mechanism on security. However, who have requested, saying they were understaffed and asked for more.
That was reporter Esther Judah in Brussels. She spoke to VOA's William Eagle.
Reuters reports Bulgaria may build a fence along its border with Greece to prevent migrants and refugees from entering. It says it's ready to take the action because the migrant route through the Western Balkans is now closed. Bulgaria and Greece share a 500-kilometer-long border. Bulgaria already is building a barbed wire fence along its border with Turkey since November 2013. It's erected about 100 kilometers of the planned 166-kilometer fence. The new deal between the EU and Turkey appears to have dealt a blow to human smuggling operations between Turkey and Greece. AFP reports that since the deal calls for sending many migrants in Greece back to Turkey for registration, fewer people are willing to pay smugglers $1,200 to cross the Aegean. Meanwhile, in Greece, there are well over 20,000 refugees in temporary shelters set up by the military. The new centers are quickly nearing capacity, and the military is looking for new locations. The situation may ease beginning April 4th, when many start returning to Turkey for registration.
In the past 18 months, well over 1 million migrants entered Europe to escape war, persecution, poverty. They came from Syria, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and North Africa. Since October, many thousands of them have been given dry clothes, hot food, medicine, and a place to sleep at all-volunteer Better Days for Moria camp on the Greek islands of Lesbos. It's a short, if treacherous, boat ride from the Turkish coast. The camp was adjacent to the official Moria registration center, where they could apply for temporary visas. Now, the new agreement between the European Union and Turkey requires that many migrants in Greece wishing to apply for refugee status or asylum in Europe be sent back to Turkey. The Better Days for Moria camp is now mostly dismantled, and the official family shelter compound has become a detention center. Earlier this year, VOA's Adam Phillips visited the camp where he interviewed migrants about their experiences. In the fifth and final part of our series on Better Days for Moria, we hear some of their stories.
It was late in the evening at Better Days for Moria, and many of the 3,000-plus migrants were asleep. Still, that didn't stop 20 or so young North African men from expressing relief that they had made it this far on their journey. Many did not. Faisal and Khalil, two new friends, both Afghanis, stood together off to the side to watch.
I'm going to Utrecht.
In the Netherlands?
Yeah, in New Zealand, yes, oh, yes. Nice. He's good.
How about you?
I want to go to Denmark. There was difficult in our country. There was Taliban war, killing people, and therefore we want to go to the place. There is no war, there is no Taliban.
You know a lot of people who died?
Yes.
Migrant families had to wait up to 5 days in large military tents like this one to get the interview that would enable them to register and stay in Europe for 30 days and apply for refugee status. If the tent supply ran low, single men often had to sleep in the open with a blanket or a sleeping bag. A dapper young Syrian named Hussein, his fiancée and her family sat on the floor, tense, anxious, and often bored amid the scattered clothes, trash, crying babies, and other families like them, waiting to be called.
I fled from death. In Syria, you only find death. I got a bachelor's degree in literature, English literature, yeah. So I would like to continue my studying.
When did you decide to leave? Was it one moment when you decided?
We had the idea right from the beginning, but we didn't have the energy, the money that helps us to go. Actually, we used to be very rich in Syria, but because of the war and every country in the world bombing us, we lost everything.
How did you get to Turkey?
You know, we crossed the border illegally. We went to Istanbul, stayed for a while. After we stayed, like, we decided to go to Europe.
And you took that boat. Was it really scary, that boat?
Yeah, yeah. As they describe it, the Syrian people, as the trip of death.
But it's better than what you were leaving.
Yes, 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 sir. Wow. Because, you know, we got nothing to lose. If we die, okay, we die.
That boat trip from Turkey to Lesbos has claimed hundreds of lives this year. But it was just one part of a treacherous 6-week journey for 23-year-old Sheryar from Pakistan. Back home in Islamabad, he survived a car bomb blast right next to his home and American drone strikes that killed many of his neighbors. Growing ever more fearful and enraged, he decided to head for the West. He took his modest savings, bid his mother's and sister's goodbye, and left with the help of smugglers to Iran, along with many other migrants.
The way they transport you is that they put 20 people in one car. They shove you in the trunk with 4 other people, and you're supposed to stay in that awkward posture for, if you're lucky, 4, 5, 6 hours. If you're not lucky enough, it's like 12 hours. So people have died. People have suffocated to death. People have had heart attacks. And since the Iranis are not so fond of Pakistanis, they beat you up pretty bad.
Did you get beat up?
Yes, I did. And then you reach the Iran-Turkey border. You cross it on foot, and you reach this place where you're supposed to pay them. Otherwise, for 2 days, they don't let you eat. And then when you pay them, you're shipped off to Istanbul. And from Istanbul, they ship you off to any beach they feel is safe. And they put you on a boat, which is supposed to carry 20 or 25 people with 50 or 60 people. And they send you off to Greece.
Since Sheryar arrived, many Balkan states had sealed their borders to Afghani and Pakistani migrants. But he couldn't return home because his government refused to welcome back anyone whom Europe had deported. Sheryar admitted that he was stuck, yet still he preferred to stay at Better Days for Moria anyway. He said he learned he had a lot to offer as a volunteer.
I want to stay here and help because I think I'm needed. I can leave whatever I want because I can speak English, and nobody would suspect that I'm a refugee. I'm privileged, but there are so many people here who cannot speak the language. I have to be here for them if they need something. I mean, like, I'm always constantly thinking about the camp. Do they have enough water for the teapots? Do they have enough people working there? Are there enough servers? Do they need me for translation? I can't even go to sleep.
Many migrants at the camp were confused, even suspicious, of the international team of volunteers they encountered at Better Days for Moria. Most said they had no culture of volunteerism back home and felt the volunteers must be getting paid by the government or receiving kickbacks. But after a week or two at the camp, Sheryar was convinced that the compassion and practical help on offer there were genuine. He said the experience changed his life.
I lost hope in humanity, but I found it because I see so many volunteers here. They've given me hope. It showed me that all people are not alike. I mean, some of them really care to come down here, work their ass off for free, and that is really amazing. That changes you. It changed me, gave me a change of heart. But I don't know what I'll find when I leave this place. I'm scared of it. I'm scared of the unknown.
Many of the fears that Shahryar and other migrants once held are now coming to pass, as the new agreement between the European Union and Turkey compel them to travel back to Turkey to register for refugee status. Their fate is uncertain at best. Some will be in refugee camps. Others may be repatriated to the dangerous lands they once fled. Still others may fall victim to those who prey on their naivete and their money. But human kindness and freedom no doubt also awaits some of them. Volunteers like those at Better Days for Moria say they'll continue to work to ease the passage of the migrants who remain and try to raise the world's awareness of those fleeing war, repression, violence, and poverty. Adam Phillips, VOA News, on Lesbos, Greece.
The Nigerian army says it freed more than 800 people this week who were being held by Boko Haram militants in the northeast. The French news agency AFP says all the hostages were rescued in Borno State. Some 520 were freed in Kusama village on Tuesday, and more than 300 were rescued in 11 other villages. The Nigerian army says it killed three militants and captured another during the raids. However, at the same time, Boko Haram abducted 16 women in neighboring Adamawa State. Villagers say the women were kidnapped while collecting firewood and fishing. Two vigilantes there were assigned to protect them fled. AFP reports two women managed to escape by jumping into the river and pretending to drown.
In other news from Nigeria, AFP reports over 300 companies and individuals have been indicted for allegedly defrauding the government of millions of dollars. They include current and retired military officers. They are accused of swindling the government with fake contracts. The president's office says it's recovered about $5 million from the indicted companies and the individuals so far.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, has joined with Anglo-Dutch consumer goods company Unilever to improve access to safe, clean water in sub-Saharan Africa. The first four countries to participate in the initiative are Kenya, Nigeria, Ghana, and Ivory Coast. The new partnership includes financial investment and working with government and civil society. UNICEF says Africa's population is surging and access to safe drinking water remains a serious problem. For example, in Kenya, one in three people lack access to safe drinking water, while in Nigeria, at least 150,000 children below the age of five die every year as a result of diarrhea. Ricardo Perez is UNICEF's communications specialist for Eastern and Southern Africa. He spoke with me about the new partnership.
Well, so as you may know, access to clean water and sanitation in sub-Saharan Africa remains a big problem. This partnership with Unilever aims at increasing access to clean water, starting in four specific countries on the continent: Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Nigeria, and Kenya. So the idea is to help the 319 million people in sub-Saharan Africa who can't still access clean water to finally be able to use safe water.
What are some of the challenges that communities are facing right now in getting access to safe drinking water?
Well, one of the main problems we face is of infrastructure. So you go to especially rural areas where people don't have the necessary means to for their daily needs, be it for consuming or for hygiene purposes. So the main problem we see at the moment is of infrastructure, but also the lack of resources to build that infrastructure, not only in rural areas, but also in urban areas.
So with this partnership, will you all be able to put in these infrastructures so that this will be a long-term project?
Yes, absolutely. The idea is to help building these infrastructures, but we also want to develop monitoring systems whereby these tools that will be built remain sustainable. So we will be looking at working with local communities and government to create a sustainable system of monitoring sustainability, not only water, but specifically in these four countries initially to access clean water.
Can you give us an example of what it actually takes to put into place access to clean water? What is the physical process?
Well, to make it sustainable and scalable across the country, you have to make sure that this infrastructure is built within a system. I'm not sure how I could give you an example of physically how infrastructure is built, rather than reinforce the fact that we're working with governments and other partners on the ground to create a sustainable system whereby populations can access safe drinking water.
Also, right now, many countries, such as the ones that you all are going to be working in, such as Kenya and Nigeria, the people lack access to safe drinking water, and children, because of that, they die every year from diseases like diarrhea. So as the populations in these countries continue to grow, if they don't get access to clean water, what will happen to these populations?
Absolutely. That's a very important point. Demographics in Africa are the challenge now and for the future. So indeed, if we don't act now, and this is part of why UNICEF is partnering with Unilever and other, you know, important institutions across the world, not only in Africa, if we don't act now to improve access to clean water, literally children's lives are at risk.
When will this partnership actually begin?
Well, it begins now. We are announcing it on World Water Day. As of then, the rollout begins with different installments of financial amounts being allocated to these countries. Once those amounts are allocated, once the partnership is actually working and UNICEF is using those resources to leverage communities and build these infrastructures or help building these infrastructures to improve access to safe, clean water, you know, the results will hopefully start showing in the next couple of months. But the implementation of the partnership starts this year and will roll out for the next 2 years.
Ricardo Perez is UNICEF's communications specialist for Eastern and Southern Africa. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yahia Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
And for all other listeners, please stay tuned for the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. And on behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Justin Thwaites, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Today on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou talks about tuberculosis. Is it making a comeback? What are the current treatments available? For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show. designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.